We've also got our producer Sophie listening on like the voice of God, or maybe like one of the three Norns weaving the fate of the rest of us mortals. How are you doing today, Sophie?
Oh, that's my favorite intro you've done. I'm great, you know, surviving kind of.
Yeah.
Excited for this script. It's a good one.
Thanks. Ooh. Thanks. Cutting some threads.
That is a great image. And Sophie is like that. Like, that was great. Perfect. A plus.
Okay, so I figured today we should do something like really lighthearted, easy breezy, and talk about Nazis. I figure no one ever talks about these guys, right?
Like, who?
When was the last time anyone talked about Nazis? So we figured we should talk about Nazis. But more specifically, I want to talk about how during the early 20th century, there was this like queer accepting culture that was blooming all across Europe, which the Nazis tried to crush. But it turns out it didn't actually work out that way in the end. The Nazis actually, spoiler alert, get crushed.
Cool.
And they took out a lot of queer people along the way.
Not
but
cool.
A lot of queer people fucked up the Nazis too. So that's what we're going to talk about today.
I like that. I like a good, like, I don't know, revenge. Yeah.
Yeah. No, this is good. I think you might like some of this story then. Obviously,
yeah.
Not all of this story, unfortunately. Okay, so I don't know if you knew this, but there's actually not one way to be gay. Different. Yeah, no, I was shocked to learn this as well.
There's not one straight way to be gay. Thank you for laughing so much.
Every culture has had different conceptions of homosexuality and transness and all of these different things, and like. To be clear, like, guys have been fucking guys since the beginning of time. Girls have been fucking girls. And wherever there's been gender, there's been people transgressing gender roles. But since Western civilization is like so I almost feel like guilty focusing on this particular conception of gayness and how we develop to our current Western conception of gayness. But since Western civilization is trying its hardest to be like the one single culture over the entire world, mm-hmm. I feel like it's worth knowing its history of queerness, or
yeah,
at least some
sure.
of it. And kind of oddly, a lot of the history we have about gayness in our culture doesn't come from like the ladies who liked scissoring, but instead the priests and the governments that tried to stop us from doing that instead.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to start with this Book of Monsters.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. Liber Monstorum. It's a series of three volumes that was written in Old English around the turn of the 8th century. And it's got like cyclopses and centaurs and shit in it. Oh. But it's not just like a collection in alphabetical order. It was written in kind of a specific, like they picked who to put first and who to put at the end. And
like
the third book.
Monster
yeah,
playlist.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a monster playlist that this guy's writing to try and impress someone probably. Which makes it perfect, actually, because the very first monster in the very first Book of Monsters in English is a trans woman, or possibly an intersex person. Those concepts were very blurry all throughout history.
Right.
And so to quote Liber Monstorum from a translation by Andy Orchard, "Indeed, I bear witness at the beginning of the work that I have known a person of both sexes who, although they appeared more masculine than feminine from their face and chest, and were thought male by those who did not know, yet loved feminine occupations and deceived the ignorant among men in the manner of a whore. But this is said to have happened often amongst the human race."
Oh, so is the person writing this pretending they're not human? Or
No. I think he's just like...
Just the way the old English works, it sounds
yeah.
strange. Okay.
Yeah, copy. Basically. Yeah. So the very first monster in all of English history is a fucking, it's me. So that rules. But
I
kind of
projecting. They're projecting. If that's yeah. the very first playlist or song in the playlist they chose, hey, look inwards.
That's a very good point. And the same book also describes it specifically quotes like Ethiopians also as monsters.
Wow.
And it's not exactly a tome I would like to see live on in the modern world in any appreciable degree. So fast forward a couple hundred years, and in the 10th century, the Church of England, they were passing around these manuals of recommended penance for sinners based on their different sins or whatever, right? And one of the passages refers to a third gender of person, which is the Badling, or maybe Badling. I don't actually know how to pronounce Old English. I'm going to go with Badling. And we know that they meant it as a third sex because the specific rule is that any man who, quote, has sex with a Badling or with another male or with a beast ought to fast for 10 years in penance.
Wow.
And so this is probably, again, the same concept. This is a concept of someone who is either intersex or trans. And it's related to all these other effeminate words that they had at the time, or words for effeminate men that they had at the time, including battle and baden or badden. There's a lot of arguments. People like to argue about this shit endlessly on the internet. I don't know if you've met the internet, but it likes to argue about shit like this. There's a chance that the word bad comes from this.
Wow.
Which I will also happily take. I'm like totally down to be the origin of monsters and bad.
I mean, bad, that's badass. I don't even mean that as a pun, but I think that's really cool.
Yeah. And different people have tried to like reclaim these words in different ways to various degrees. But okay, fast forward even more. And you've got two important pieces of legislation whose bigotry has echoed throughout the world, thanks to colonialism.
Yay.
The Holy Roman Empire, which stretched from northern Italy up to modern day Germany. In 1532, it passed something called the, I don't know how to pronounce Latin, even though I took 3 years of it, Constitutio Criminalis Carolina. And one of the laws in this set of laws is, when a human commits fornication with a beast, a man with a man, a woman with a woman, they have also forfeited life. And they should be, according to the common custom, banished by fire from life into death.
Jesus.
Yeah. So they weren't like huge fans of homosexuality.
No, not really, it seems like. They just kind of hate us.
Yeah, yeah. The very next year, it must have been like sweeping the Europe at the time, because the very next year, Henry VIII of England in 1533, he passed the Buggery Act, which made anal sex and bestiality punishable by death. And
it's just so disgusting to me that those are always coupled together. Like,
yeah.
And I say this as someone that used to have a friend like 5 years ago that was arguing that point. And I'm not her friend anymore. But like, I could not believe someone my age would be able to still have any thought about that. And it blew my mind. So I'm very, I just hate, that's just, it's beyond upsetting and disgusting to me. I just, ugh.
Yeah.
Whatever.
I agree.
No, it's like, just... I don't know. It just makes me really mad that humans are like that. But also, like, okay, I studied art history in college, and the Roman Empire or whatever the shit, a lot of their artworks involve all genders everywhere, and their gods are intersex and all this stuff. So it's just so ironic to me that they're also burning people alive.
I honestly, like, the best I can figure out, and I'm not sure, but the best I can figure out from, like, all this research I'm doing for this episode is that, like, not only have there, it's like, it's not like everyone was just like hiding and in the closet and afraid of the witch hunters the whole time. It seems like it like cycled. People would be like, oh, being gay rules. And then people like, yeah, it does rule. And then I would just have like a whole culture of people being like, this rules. And then someone would get into a moral panic and then murder us all and drive the rest of us back into the closet, which is a really cool pattern that we are hopefully not in the middle of right now.
Well, that makes me very nervous, the way you said that.
But we'll keep going with this story.
I was not thinking about that at all. Okay, continue.
All right. So England's laws get exported all over the world because they are fucking colonialist scum. And the Holy Roman Empire's law becomes Prussian law, which becomes German law, and then becomes Nazi law. And then actually stays the law after the Nazis go away, too. But we'll get to that. So the Nazis didn't invent the prosecution of gay people, the persecution of gay people. They just turned it up to 11. In contrast, during all this time, France, when they did their whole revolution thing, in 1791, they legalized homosexuality. And
wow, that's pretty incredible. I didn't know that.
No, I didn't either, honestly. And then I hate that I'm about to say something positive about a Napoleon. But then when he went around and conquered Europe, he brought the French law with him and eradicated anti-gay laws everywhere he went.
Wow. That short king.
I know.
Shireen.
Hey, that is pretty freaking cool.
Yeah. And so it's like, so Prussia becomes Germany by bringing in Bavaria and some other regions. And Bavaria actually had legalized homosexuality, but Prussia did not. So in 1871, when Prussia becomes Germany, the whole country suddenly has an anti-gay law again. And it's a law called Paragraph 175. And it was the law in Germany from fucking 1871 until... Do you want to guess what decade they got rid of Paragraph 1871?
What decade? I don't know. I'm genuinely going to say like 1960 or something.
No.
1994.
I was going to say you were alive. You were alive.
Oh my God. I just thought like after fucking, I don't know, NATO won, maybe they were like in a good mood and no, never mind. The 60s sucked, now that I think about it. But that is very unfortunate and sad.
Unsettling.
Yeah.
And they did like, they did reform the laws in the late 60s and early 70s. And like, and I think what they did, I don't have the notes in front of me, but I think what they ended up doing was making it so that there was just a higher age of consent for gayness than for straightness or whatever. So like straight kids were allowed to fuck at 14, but gay kids weren't allowed to fuck until they're 21 or something, which is like progress, but in the weirdest, most horrible way, you know?
Yeah.
So this law, paragraph 175, is unnatural fornication, whether between persons of the male sex or humans with beasts, is punished with imprisonment, with the further punishment of prompt loss of civil rights.
Whoa.
And okay, so like most of these laws are just about men, right? The Holy Roman Emperor one managed to include lesbians as well. But so Germany, they actually tried to extend it to include lesbians a couple times, but they couldn't reach consensus on exactly like how women would go about fucking each other. And so like exactly what would be illegal. And
that's so funny. It's like straight guys making lesbian porn or something. You know what I mean? They're just like, is this what they do? Let's throw that in.
Yeah, totally. I just like to imagine that there's like this room full of dudes in like powdered wigs or maybe like hats with spikes on them. And they're like trying to mimic exactly what they thought. Maybe like one of them cuts their fingers with some scissors by accident or something, you know? And in England in 1921, they tried to expand the law to women as well, the English law. But they got afraid that if they did, it might give women ideas. So the Earl of I don't know how to pronounce English names.
Well, I mean, like, women can't have ideas, though, Margaret. Like, that's so dangerous.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this actually ties into I think the reason that men hate lesbians is that they realize that if women can enjoy each other, then the men have no purpose.
100%.
And I actually think this is why they even hate trans women, especially, or also, is because like, because they could hold on to like, well, at least the human race wouldn't continue. And you're like, sorry, we're gonna fuck that one up for you too.
Well, no, I think you're correct. That is why.
So okay, so the Earl of Desert, I'm just gonna call him Desert. Desert. I don't know if I could.
Vote Desert.
Okay. They colonized like half the fucking world. They can get their names wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
How many people does one suppose really are so vile, so unbalanced, so neurotic, so decadent as to do this? You may say there are a number of them, but would it be like at most an extremely small minority? And you're going to tell the whole world that there is such an offense, to bring it to the notice of women who have never heard of it, never thought of it, never dreamed of it? I think that is a very great mischief.
I love that. I love that performance.
This thanks. Is
great.
Thanks.
But I was just thinking about it. Like, annihilating the human race, or not annihilating, but slowly killing us off. That would be, have you seen us? Have you seen this planet? Like, that's the way to save the world. Lesbians and trans women.
Yeah.
Like, the men that wrote that, just probably so gay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. We're going to like, there's a lot of different conceptions that come up about like, you know, whether sexuality is in it or whether it's like socially contagious and like
Oh, so that wasn't even part of the question yet. It was more just like the act.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I was saying that later in the script we're going to talk about.
Oh, sorry. I thought you meant the law.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No, no. So they didn't expand the law to include women because they couldn't, you know, they didn't want to give any women ideas. But, okay, despite the fact that there's all these anti-gay laws on the books, 1920s and 1930s Germany was like fucking unbelievably gay through and through. Left wing, right wing, center, gay people everywhere. And of course, a lot of these people were fighting for their rights, which brings us to the Institute for Sexual Research. From 1919 to 1933, there was a place in Berlin called the Institute for Sexual Research, which was opened by three Jewish sexologists. The most famous of these is a guy named Magnus Hirschfeld. And this place, I don't know, as far as I can tell, fucking ruled, right? 20,000 people visited every year from around the world. There was this museum of sex. There was a massive research archive. They offered consulting on matters of sex to gay and straight people. Like if you were confused about your sexuality, you could just like show up at the Institute and someone would set you straight or gay. They'd help you.
I wish I had that now.
I know.
That's so ahead of its time.
I know. And they did endless scientific research into homosexuality. Some of it seems like really weird today. Like at one point they spent a while trying to, and this is all voluntary, but they tried to transplant testicles from straight men into gay men to see if it would cure the gay men of their gay.
Oh, wow.
But they, and again, this wasn't a forced conversion therapy. This was like people being like, I want to do this or whatever.
Yeah.
But they kind of dropped anything like conversion therapy pretty quickly. And then they moved apparently all their focus to helping people navigate homophobic society rather than, you know, trying to fucking cure them or whatever. They coined the words both transvestite and transsexual. I know transvestite isn't in vogue now, but like it actually was a word that meant a lot to me as some when I was younger before I identified it as transgender. Because yeah. I prefer
words
women's
change.
Clothes. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, words change and they evolve in their meaning, and
yeah.
I had no idea that's where they were coined from. What an amazing little institute.
Oh yeah, no, this place is just like did so much cool shit. They pioneered this idea. I mean, I'm sure other people came up with this idea too, but they pioneered this idea as like a scientific thing that if you just let trans people exist and you let us like go through society the way that we know we belong in society, that we're happier and society is happier and we don't like kill ourselves as much. Because like, you know, homophobic societies drive an awful lot of people to hurt themselves.
And the government hears that and they're like, no, we have to keep them miserable or else they won't need us. We have to keep them scared and miserable and sad. That's actually the truth. So.
Yeah, I genuinely believe that. They're like, I'm miserable, so you have to be miserable. Yeah, you know?
Exactly.
Okay, and they performed probably the first gender confirmation surgery in history, or at least the one that's like known about in Western records or whatever. I have a feeling some people tried and did this a long time ago too, but this woman named Dora Richter in 1930 was the first person to, in our understanding, to undergo full like gender confirmation surgery. And she actually worked at the Institute. She was a maid, basically. It was one of the only places in Germany where trans people could get jobs. But I honestly, I don't know how well they were treated. It sounded like they all got kind of shit jobs. Like this woman was a maid. And Hirschfeld was like, traveling around staying in luxury hotels and shit.
Oh, there's always a negative side, I'm sure, to everybody.
Yeah. And they also were tied in with the first Western pro-homosexual advocacy group in history, which was the Scientific Humanitarian Committee, which was founded in 1897. And they treated homosexuality as gender. So this gets into there's a lot of different conceptions about gayness arguing at the time. And the Institute's theory was that homosexuality and gender exist in the body and are essentially determined at birth rather than being conscious choices, which led them down to some strange paths. They presented this idea that homosexuals were sort of a third sex halfway between men and women, which implied that like all lesbians are a bit masculine and all gay men are like a bit feminine. They did, however, separate out trans people from all of this to not be exactly the same as gay people. So it was like progress. And they got away with a lot of this gayness because even a 175, paragraph 175 was technically a law in the books. The local government basically told the police like, no, don't enforce this, because the local government was like far more progressive.
That's something at least.
But I mean, it's also interesting, this guy Magnus Hirschfeld wasn't out as gay. He was very, very clearly gay, but he wasn't out, and like lived with his partner and was active in the gay scene. And I don't love everything that this guy did. For one thing, as part of the coalition to abolish paragraph 175, the law that they advocated instead would have legalized homosexual prostitution. And he was, and Magnus was like, no, take that part out. Not because he like hated sex work, but because he, it would be like too controversial. It would like fuck, the, you know, and
yeah,
I don't know. Sex workers get thrown under the bus fucking constantly. And it also kind of throws on working class gay folks under the bus more, right? If you do that.
Yeah, exactly.
And he was also super fucking assimilationist. I'm not trying to like rag on this guy, but I feel like you got to understand him, you know?
If you had stopped like 3 minutes ago at like he started the institution, whatever, mm-hmm. like that's great. But this is an example of like, don't meet your heroes, right?
Yeah,
like,
totally.
I would have just kept him as like this heroic figure yeah. if you just stopped there.
Yeah.
It's good to know everything. It's good to know
yeah.
everything.
So at one point he was like, when he was trying to convince everyone that gays were cool, he would like bring cops to gay bars and to be like, look, we're just like everyone else. And like, I like to imagine being in that bar and trying to be like, okay, we're what? We're like everyone else. All right. Yeah. Totally. Everyone put on your
casual.
Everyone else. Yeah, yeah. Totally. Like, quick, stop fucking in public.
Yeah.
And they also, okay. So they weren't the only game in town either. There was this anarchist named Adolf Brand who started the world's first gay magazine. Again, whenever I say like the world's first or whatever, I want to like really heavily disclose that like all of these history books are going to call it the first whatever. And they mean the Western world and, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. Still fucking cool. They started this gay magazine in the fucking 19th century in 1896. And the name of the magazine translates to The Unique. And he was really fucking out. Like, he kept getting arrested for being gay. And they would be like, are you gay? And he'd be like, fuck yeah, I'm gay. Fuck you. and I don't love this guy either. I'm going to get to that. But he didn't fuck around with this, like, gayness is effeminate thing. To him, male homosexuality was, like, the epitome of masculinity.
Mm.
Often bordering on or falling into outright misogyny, right? Because it's, like, men who only need men. And,
right.
Which we've all run across,
yeah.
you know.
I mean, both, yeah, with women and with men, I would say that happens.
Totally. Totally. And then the activism that came out of his circle was called the Path Over Corpses, and which is really metal, but not actually very cool. And what they did is they outed high-profile gay men.
Wait, like,
often,
continue.
Often leading to those people to kill themselves.
Oh, holy shit.
And they just didn't care, and that's why it was called the Path Over Corpses.
They invented cancel culture.
Yeah.
They invented cancel culture.
Whoa.
We don't even need Twitter anymore.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. That's one way to go about it, but like, that's not a great way.
Yeah. And I usually root for the anarchists in anything, but like, mm-hmm. I actually, not this time.
No.
Okay. And then there's this third conception that I think was floating around a bit the Western world, but actually, as far as I can tell in my limited reading, was far more common in like Southwest Asia and Northern Africa, which was this, and gay men from the West would go visit Southwest Asia to go be a bit more free for a while. And it was this conception that sexuality and gender weren't things that you are, but instead they're things that you do.
Interesting.
And all of those are going to come up through the different characters that we're going to get to as part of why I'm trying to lay the scene.
Yeah. No, yeah. Very interesting.
But you know what else is wholesome besides sexuality is I've decided that the show will only be sponsored by incredibly wholesome things, the most wholesome things we can think of. And so today, Sophie, can we just be sponsored by tap water? Like the concept of tap water?
I mean, but what about the potatoes?
That's true. I do really like potatoes. Okay. Tap water and potatoes, two things that are
fair
very wholesome.
Enough.
Balance it out.
I mean, yeah. That seems fair. We do need more than one sponsor.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that.
Protect the potato.
Yeah. Okay. So we're sponsored by those things and then maybe these other things, and we'll be right back. Okay. And we are back. And of all of these different, you know, types of things that are happening, it seems like Hirschfeld and the Institute had the longest and most widespread impact on the Western world. And the Nazis didn't like that. at all, it turns out. Do you know that famous photo of Nazis burning books? Or like, if you imagine Nazis burning books.
Yeah, yes. The image popped in my head, yeah.
Yeah. So, and everyone's like, oh, look, the Nazis are bad, they burned books. And what usually goes unsaid is that the books they were burning was the research library of the Institute of Sexual Research in these photos.
Wow. Why don't they mention that? They should at least mention that in a caption somewhere. Like, what?
The huge pile of books on fire.
Yeah.
And then just Nazis-Nazi-ing. Yeah.
Wow. And I mean, definitely didn't help that they were Jewish either, right? That
yeah, exactly.
That started it.
Yeah. Honestly, I think the reason it isn't mentioned is because I think that most of polite Western society was secretly fucking glad that all those fucking books got burned. And like, you know, we're erased from history in a lot of different ways. And the Nazis liked erasing us more actively than the sort of like liberal democracies. But they like trying fucking too.
It's dark, but true. And unfortunately.
Yeah. On May 6th, 1933, the Nazis showed up and they burned like 20,000 books, destroying endless amounts of research into homosexuality, transsexuality, cross-dressing, everything. Joseph Goebbels, I don't know how to pronounce Goebbels' name, which I should because he's like one of the famous people in history. He's the chief propagandist of the Nazis, and he gives a speech to 40,000 people during this fucking book burning. And Dora Richter, the first trans woman to undergo gender confirmation surgery, probably was killed in this attack. It's possible that she was arrested and died in prison shortly after. There are a couple rumors that people that don't have as much evidence to back them up that she like got out. And I like to think she got out, but she probably didn't. Meanwhile, Magnus Hirschfeld, he sees the writing on the wall like before all this happens. And so he's off on a world tour, basically trying to figure out where the fuck to get his gay Jewish ass to. Because he's like, this is not going to fucking work. I can't stay where there's Nazis. But he didn't destroy his own records and lists of names before he left.
Oh.
So the Nazis got those. And those are like the one things they didn't burn was the list of like all the fucking gay people in Germany.
Shit.
Not clearly not all of them, you know, but.
Yeah, but that's. Shit, I can't wait to hear what happens next.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so the Nazis get those. They use them in a campaign to eradicate the homosexual blight because the Nazis, minus the gay Nazis I'll talk about in a second, or later, they sure didn't see homosexuality as like something inherent and natural. They saw it as a plague that needed to be destroyed, let it infest everything or whatever. So Magnus Hirschfeld, he never comes back to Germany. He goes into exile in France and he dies of a heart attack on his 67th birthday on May 14th, 1935. Adolf Brand, the anarchist who path over corpses guys, he was super brave before the Nazis. And then when the Nazis come over, he retires from activism, marries a woman to try and like play straight. And then he just like shut the fuck up and tried to survive the war. And he didn't because an Allied bomb fell on his house in Berlin in 1945, died at the age of 70. The Nazis then expanded paragraph 175 like substantially. It used to be gay men can't fuck, but then it became gay men can't try to excite the sexuality of other men. And so
that's where the plague like mentality comes in. Like,
yeah,
you know, like if this gay guy even comes near me, like,
yeah,
maybe I'll my thoughts will be unleashed.
Yeah, I keep thinking about dick.
Yeah,
exactly. Many people do. It's a natural thought.
Yep.
Okay, so like something like 100,000 men who are accused of homosexuality are arrested, and a lot of them are like, this is often like it's a really easy way to blackmail people. It's very similar to like witch hunting. You know, like you're mad at someone, just say he came on to you, and you can get someone arrested. So 100,000 men are arrested. Half of those did prison time. 10,000 of them or so, everyone argues about numbers, were sent to concentration camps where they were forced to wear the inverted pink triangle badges, which is where the pink triangle as a symbol comes from. In the camps, at least by everything I read, they were treated socially like kind of the worst. It was like them and Jews at the bottom of everything. And then gay Jews had to wear like an inverted, it was both a pink triangle and a yellow Star of David over top of each other, and they had it the worst. I read really gnarly accounts of what they suffered, and I'm not going to tell you about it.
Thank you for that. Thank you so much. My imagination is enough. Yes.
Yeah. and about 40% of them survive. So 60% of them die. And there's no law on the books against lesbianism, but the Nazis didn't like gay women any better. And so what they did is they basically found excuses to send as many of them as possible to the camps, non-Aryan ones in particular, and then Aryan ones would get forced to have babies, which, again, we will leave there. And those who resisted were arrested on imaginary charges. Like, two women were arrested for disrupting their workplace by sleeping with women from work.
Interesting.
So Nazis didn't like gay people. But fortunately for history, a lot of gay people didn't like Nazis either, and they decided to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us to one of the best places in LGBT history, Amsterdam. I fucking love Amsterdam.
I still gotta go there. I want to go there. That's like one of my top places I want to visit.
It's, yeah. I remember like sitting on a triangle memorial. It was like a dock into one of the canals. It's like a triangle memorial when I was like a baby, barely even knew I was queer, like traveling squatter staying there.
Wow. That must have been powerful, I can imagine.
Yeah. Okay, so one of the most iconic acts of gay resistance to the Nazis is in Amsterdam after the occupation. It's a story that weaves together some of like my favorite people I've run across in history, at least judging by their actions. I actually don't know much about them as people, but you know, like, they did fucking cool shit. And we're going to start with Willem Arondaeus. He was born in 1895 in Amsterdam into a theater family. His parents were costume designers. Originally, he's an artist, right? And they supported him in his art, of his writing and painting. But then he came out when he was 17 as gay, and they kicked him out of the house. Homosexuality was legal in the Netherlands, but, you know, no one liked it. I mean, lots of people liked it, but, you know, society liked to frown upon it. So he develops his art. He starts taking on commercial art jobs. He paints ads, stamps, that kind of shit. He did some like tapestries and coats of arms for some cities, at least one of which is still around. He did a mural for the Rotterdam Town Hall. And you can look up his art, actually. It's really good. Anyone listening, you should look it up because I think y'all should get tattoos of it because it fucking rules. But it's like more designery than fine art, and which I think is cool. And some of his art is on display at the Met and at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. But he wasn't really well known at the time, to be real. He's a commercial artist, not some like...
Yeah. I mean, most artists are not really well known or famous until after they pass.
Yeah, totally. And if you want to be a famous artist, you should do stuff like Willem goes on to do. That's my recommendation to you. Okay, so he spends years of his life partnered with a man named Jan Thiessen, and he supports the two of them barely on his art and on the royalties from a biography he writes about a painter named Matthias Maris, who had fought in the Paris Commune. But Willem is dirt poor, largely unknown. He shifts to novels in 1935, and he publishes novels with the names like The Owl House, The Tragedy of the Dream, and then this is my favorite because it's the most Dutch gay title I've ever heard in my life, and I love it. In the Blossoming Winter Radish.
Oh my gosh. Perfect. No notes.
I know.
No notes.
I know. I want to read it. And the Nazis take over in 1940. And they start off kind of trying to be nice to some of the Dutch people, clearly not all of the Dutch people. But homosexuality had been legal in the Netherlands for more than a century. And so Willem is one of the first people to go off and join the Dutch resistance, which was actually more nonviolent in character than elsewhere in Europe. But they weren't slouchers. By the autumn of 1944, the resistance was hiding or had hidden 300,000 people. And somewhere between 60 to 200,000 people were doing that hiding. And over 1 million people were actively letting all of that happen just by like knowing their neighbor is hiding somebody and not fucking saying anything about it.
Yeah, like allies.
Yeah.
Potentially. Yeah. So that's a big number. I wasn't expecting that high of a number, but that's pretty incredible.
Yeah. And like gives me a little bit of hope whenever I want to drag hope out of this kind of thing. Oh, that's the point of this podcast, right? there's over 1,100 separate resistance newspapers, which reach a readership of over 100,000 people during the occupation. But Willem's partner can't handle all the heat in Amsterdam, and he fucks off and moves back to a small town somewhere else. And Willem stays in Amsterdam, and he keeps going. In 1942, he starts an underground newspaper called Brandaris Brief, which means letter of insignia. In 1943, it merges with another paper called, I'm just going to say the English translations, called The Free Artist, which was edited by a man named Gerrit von der Veen, who's another one of today's heroes, actually, but I believe tragically heterosexual.
Oh, God. You know. No one's perfect.
Exactly. Exactly. And he doesn't get as much screen time in the story, so I want to tell you a little bit about our man, Gerrit. I could be mispronouncing his name. I'm actually sorry, Dutch listeners, but I can pronounce the name Sjoerd, which is going to come a little later. Anyway. Okay. So he starts off his career as a mechanical engineer, but he really just wants to be a sculptor. And then one day before the Nazi invasion and shit, he's standing on the shore when a fully loaded oil tanker catches fire. So the crew flees and gets away, but he dives into the water, swims out to the ship, extinguishes the fire in the engine room.
Whoa.
I know.
Yeah.
He's just like this guy on the shore who's like, oh shit, a fire. I'm gonna go put it out.
It's like Keanu Reeves helping what's her face when like someone's car breaks down. He like goes and helps that person. And then but no one has evidence of this. So that guy just did it.
Yeah. Like,
he didn't need paparazzi to capture it.
Yeah, well, totally. Totally.
A good person.
Yeah. And so
one of those.
So the sailors, they're so grateful that they buy him a ticket to Amsterdam and pay for a year's tuition for him to go to art school, or like an allowance for him to become a sculptor, because that's what he wants to do, is he wants to go become a sculptor. So he does. He becomes a sculptor because he's performed this heroic deed.
Wow.
And his shit is really good. Like looking at photos of him and stuff, a lot of it's still around. But after the invasion, and I believe he's of Aryan ancestry, but I'm not sure. And they ask him to sign a paper saying, sign this paper to say you are of Aryan ancestry. And he's like, no, fuck no, I'm not going to do that. Because he's a good person. So instead, he goes underground. He starts a newspaper. And most importantly to our story, he starts forging IDs for Jews and other people who are hiding from the Nazis. So Willem joins von der Veen's crew. And it's made up of like artists and dancers and poets and shit. A lot of them are openly gay. And they just start cranking out fake IDs just all over the fucking place. They made more than 80,000 fake IDs. And because everyone over the age of 15 was required by the Nazis to carry an ID, and Jewish names were like, Jewish ones were marked with a big J on them, the counterfeiters called their services Personals Proof Central, and they sold the IDs, but at a sliding scale. So basically, if you were rich, you'd pay a lot of money. And then if you're poor, you would pay no money.
Love that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's how they finance the whole thing, you know? And
yeah, that's how the world should be, to be honest. But
yeah, totally. Okay, and so then there's a problem. They're making all these IDs, but there's records on everyone being stored in a storehouse. So curious Nazis and collaborators, which I guess you could just call them Nazis, honestly. That's the word for Nazi collaborator, I think.
Yes, yes, 100%.
So they just go and double check the IDs against the records stored in the warehouse and then bust people later. And so, but the Dutch resistance had people everywhere, including in these records keeping storehouses or whatever. And so they're working as fast as they can to falsify documents. I think they're basically saying like, okay, we did this following ID, change the records. And they're like, okay. And they go and they change the records, but it's not fast enough. And by the start of 1943, they all get this sense that like really bad shit is coming. And so they like need to step this up. So they come up with a plan. And okay, so the problem is that there's a bunch of records, right? And the records are stored in a building, right? But buildings are notoriously vulnerable to explosions in like the game of paper, rock, scissors,
you know? Yeah.
Dynamite are the kryptonite of buildings, one might say. I like when Sophie laughs at my scripted jokes.
Hey, a laugh from Sophie is so affirming. I get it.
I agree.
It was funny in writing and when you said it.
Thanks.
What can I say?
So a lot of this crew are pacifists. Not all of them. We'll get to that later, but some of them were. So they devise a plan to not only destroy hundreds of thousands of Nazi records and blow up a building, but to do it without killing or seriously injuring anyone. Which is my argument is that these people invented the heist movie.
yeah, that's funny.
And this is
laughing. No, I'm kidding. To be honest, it takes a lot for me to laugh out loud. Like when I'm watching comedy or whatever, I'm usually just silent and I feel like a piece of shit. But I find things funny. I just don't react.
It's fine. It's fine. I understand. Okay,
I'm
so
glad you thought that was funny.
So this is not a small plot. In the end, 15 people get arrested for it, and there's so many more people involved than that. But to tell it like a heist movie, I'm going to start with the action. On March 27th, 1943, Arondeus and a whole crew of other people, they dress up as like army captains and shit. Police captains, actually, I think. They march over to the record storehouse and they're like, hey, they say to the guards, because the guards are on, you know, they're like, something's up. We're going to be really careful. And so they show up and they're like, hey, we think that there's people trying to blow up this building. So we're here to sweep the building and check for explosives.
Wow, I love this. I love this. Where is this movie?
And so the guards believe them and let them in. And then Dummies. Medical students who are with them pull out syringes full of sedatives and inject the guards, rendering them unconscious. They drag them over to the zoo next door because this building's next to the zoo and just like leave them unconscious in the zoo.
Okay, zoo twist, not expecting that. Last thing I thought you were going to say was zoo. That's incredible. I love that addition to their plan.
Yeah.
They could have just left them there, but they put them in a zoo.
Right. No, exactly. Because they didn't want to hurt anybody. So they pull all the records they can find. They pile them up in the center of the room. They pour benzene on them as an accelerant. They place bombs. They grab all the blank IDs and all the money that they can find. And they get the fuck out. And the building goes boom.
Successful heist movie.
Yeah. It wasn't completely destroyed, but the building is soon on fire. So the fire department comes and they show up kind of late. And then they kind of take their sweet time putting out the fire. And then when the fire is out, they just keep pouring water on the building. Just keep going. Because they're trying to destroy all the records because the fire department got tipped off saying, Hey, can you help us destroy this building?
You can always count. Okay, the fire department.
Yeah,
I mean, you can always count on them. Like, you know, there's cops.
Yeah,
and there's firemen, and there's always a good guy. And yeah. It comes from history, obviously.
The way that my dad put it once is that no one becomes a firefighter because they enjoy having power over other people.
Damn, I love that. I've never heard it in those words, but yes,
yeah,
yes, and opposite for cops.
Yeah, exactly. So in the end, they destroyed about 800,000 records on people, which it gets painted as this failure because that was only about 15% of the total that were stored in the building. Wow. But they make it out with 600 blank IDs and 50,000 guilders. And I could not for the life of me figure out how much 50,000 guilders is in today's money in U.S. dollars. I tried. I promise I tried.
I'm going to say it's a lot.
Yeah. It's more money than I currently have. I'm willing to bet. And yeah, it's like, okay, so sometimes like history is like, oh, and they kind of failed. And I'm like, okay, they didn't like single-handedly save everyone in Amsterdam all at once, but they fucking destroyed 800,000 records and like saved thousands of lives, you know?
They put guards in zoos.
I know.
I would say it's mostly a success. I mean, obviously not like stupendously, I don't know,
right. But
yeah.
Okay, so there was a traitor in their midst. And unfortunately for the heist movie and for them and for us, we actually don't know who the traitor was.
Fucking Judas.
Yeah. And they get sold out. And one by one, the conspirators get arrested. Willem, when he's arrested, they grab his journal and use it to catch a bunch more of the people. And like, just, I'm really not trying to shame anybody, but if you're going to blow up a Nazi warehouse, you should burn all the evidence at your earliest convenience. So
keep that in mind.
Yeah, exactly. And OK, so 15 of them are rounded up. Willem Arondeus, his defense in court is basically like, I did literally all of it. Blame it all on me. No one else had anything to do with it. And it's not the first time that doing research for this podcast, I've run across people using this defense in court because it's a cool thing that cool people sometimes do. And it saves two of his co-defendants' lives. Two of the medical students are like, just given like 15 years in prison or whatever, which fortunately means they're given a couple years in prison and then, you know, the Allies liberate the Netherlands. But he didn't save everyone. Along with 12 others, he was marched out to the dunes and executed. His last communication was through his lawyer, who was also a badass. I'm going to talk about her in a little bit. And he said to her, and this gets translated 1,000 different ways in every retelling of it, but he said to her basically, never let them say that homosexuals are cowards.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is beautiful.
Yeah.
What a life. What a good guy.
I know.
That is, I like this show.
Thanks. I do too. I cried so many times while I was like researching this episode because, I mean, this guy just wanted to fucking like paint and write novels and like fuck his mm-hmm. boyfriend. And then instead Nazis took over his fucking country and he did what he fucking had to do. Yeah. And like,
and the other guy that's like a sculptor.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you're not allowed to express yourself creatively or like as an artist. You're like, you're forced into activism almost because to survive. Yeah. If that makes sense.
Totally.
Not forced, but you're by default.
Totally.
But yeah, it's, wow. I'm glad I know about these people now. Thanks. That is cool.
I'm gonna tell you about more of them.
Yay! More cool people that do cool things.
Okay, I'm gonna tell you about his boyfriend next. Not the one who fucked off because shit got too hot, but the one that he dated later and was dating during mm-hmm. it all. His name was Schwerdbacher. And
that's the name you can say.
Yeah, totally. Because one of my best friends in Amsterdam, his name is Schwerd. And I actually am still not saying it correctly. But you know,
No one has to know.
Yeah. Everyone named Schwerd knows.
Got it.
Hopefully my friend Schwerd is listening to this and forgives me. Okay, so he's a tailor, not my friend. My friend owns a pizza shop. But this guy is a tailor. And mm-hmm. Schwerdbacher, he sewed the counterfeit police uniforms that they all wore into the office. And because he was Willem's partner, the defense tried a strategy of like basically be like, go easy on him. He only did it because he was in love with Willem. And then Schwerd was like, oh, fuck no. Like, no, I fucking did it and I would fucking do it again. Like, fuck that.
Wow. So again, not cowards.
Yeah.
Like, that's like, you know what? That's amazing.
Yeah.
He could have just fucking saved his ass.
I know. And then instead, and this is the gayest part of all and the part that I fucking love. Right before he dies, he's offered one last request. And I'm going to see if I can say it without choking up. He asks for his pretty pink shirt. And so he puts on his pretty pink shirt. And that's a pretty pink shirt is a translation. It's a machine translation. But he asks for his pretty pink shirt. He gets marched out to the dunes and he gets executed alongside his lover. And it was his shirt, his pink shirt, that helped people identify the bodies of all the people who got executed.
My eyes are kind of watery.
I know.
That is so sweet and sad.
I know. And then his brother and his uncle kept fighting and they also died later in the resistance. But then you got someone who survives. Frida Belafonte, who's a part Jewish lesbian cellist and conductor. And she's the first woman in the world to serve as the permanent conductor for a professional orchestra. But that comes later because she survives. And it's not very often that you get to say the lesbian survives in a story like this, you know? She was this promising cellist. She won a conducting competition against entirely men. And then Nazis take over. And as someone whose father but not mother was Jewish, she was allowed to apply for a special dispensation to keep working professionally under the Nazi regime, at least at the start. But she was like, no, fuck you. I'm not going to fucking do that. And so she puts down her music career, puts it on hold, and she goes underground and starts forging fake IDs. And after the bombing, she goes underground again and she dresses as a man, as she often did to avoid detection or for whatever reason that she felt like dressing like a man. Probably being part of an expert fake ID ring helps when you're trying to go underground, you know?
Yeah. I would imagine that's a good asset to have.
Yeah.
I was just thinking like how all these badass people, they consciously, like, every opportunity that was presented to them as like, you can save yourself, like you can have an easier life,
yeah,
if you just like kind of what's the word, like
I can't think of the word either, but if you just roll over and just go along with it,
not consolidate, but there's a word that I'm thinking of that's not the word,
yeah.
But it's really cool that with every opportunity that was presented to them, they're still like, no, this is who I am, I'm not a coward.
Yeah.
It's not even, I don't even think the kind of, I would go on record saying like they didn't even think of it that way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They just did it because that's the right thing to do and they're good people.
Totally. I think that they were just like, that's not an option. Like, why would I?
Yeah, exactly.
But what is an option is buying fake IDs from our sponsor, fakeidring.com. Is it net or com, Sophie?
I think it's org.
Yeah, I was going to say what Shireen said. It's definitely .org.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Nonprofit.
Yeah. And so for our next wholesome sponsor is the concept of fake IDs, as well as whatever other ads come after I say this and then stop talking.
But mostly fake IDs.
Yeah.
Mostly
fake IDs. And potatoes.
Yeah.
And potatoes.
Here's some ads. Okay. And we are back. So Frida, so resistance folks smuggle her first to Belgium, to France, and then she has to get across the Alps into Switzerland, but it's winter. So she crosses on foot. She crosses the fucking Alps on foot in winter.
Holy shit. That is not easy.
Yeah, it's like not something I'm trying to do, you know?
No.
Yeah. I already thought she was a badass like before the break, but now it's like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
Confirmed.
Yeah. So she makes it to Switzerland and she starts a choir in the refugee camp.
Of course she does.
I know.
I love her.
And then she becomes local to you all. After the war, she moves to Orange County, California. I actually don't know where Orange County is. I think it's LA.
We don't claim or we don't know.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Technically, like if you're looking at a map, mm-hmm. sure, but we don't claim. Los Angeles does not claim Orange County.
Okay.
Maybe back then,
yeah.
It was more like, oh, this is all this hot desert SoCal. We're all the same, but no. At this point, Orange County is like a red.
Very red, very anti-vaccine, very anti-mask situation.
I was
in the
born
last couple years.
In Anaheim. Anaheim is part of Orange County, and I was born there.
Oh,
so.
Well, shout out to Anaheim for doing something right.
Yeah. Just me.
Just giving a shrine.
Literally, all I know about Orange County is that someone I went to high school with was an actor on the OC.
That's as much as you should know, honestly.
Yeah,
you're good.
The theme song just went bursting into my head.
Actually, wait. I know people from Anaheim are going to be like mad at me for even saying that, so I had to look it up. Oh no, it is.
Okay.
It's the second largest city in Orange County. Okay, great, because that's also where Disney is. So I was like, wait, is it Los Angeles or Orange County? Okay, sorry, anyone out there. Please don't at me. Thanks.
Okay. So now everyone knows that I don't know anything about California. I'm a fucking Appalachian girl at the moment.
It's okay. That's what we're here for.
Yeah.
Honestly, I wish I did not know anything about this place. I wish I was catapulted into outer space. I don't want to be here. I don't want to know anything.
What Shireen said.
Good to know.
Thanks.
Frida wanted to be there, not LA, but Orange County. So she goes to Orange County, mm-hmm. and she organizes the Philharmonic Orchestra and does it as a nonprofit, and all their concerts are free to the public. And she runs the orchestra for about 15 years, and now she's the aforementioned first permanent conductor of an orchestra or whatever, a woman conductor of an orchestra. And then one day, after like 15 years, someone's like, and I'm paraphrasing here as in making this exact way it goes up, whatever, I'm making this part up, but not the thing that happened, just the words.
Yeah.
Okay. So one day someone's like, oh shit, we're letting a woman run an orchestra. And so they start talking about firing her, right? Because like, whoops, we accidentally let a woman.
Yeah.
But then they're going back and forth about it. They're like, yeah, but she's like really good. Like maybe we should let her keep doing it. And then someone's like, wait. But she's also a lesbian. So she gets fired.
Oh no. Oh, God, fuck that person.
Yeah. And I feel like it's like worth pointing out that like, you know, like a lot of World War II is like the bad guys and then the so-so guys, you know?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
It's not like everyone fucking like, it's not like Britain was like, man, we're so whatever. Britain's really anti-Semitic too, is what I'm trying to say, but there's still the like a scale, you know?
I agree. It's not black and white thinking. There's no good and evil. Like, you know what I mean? Like, again, what you said earlier, people that support Nazis are Nazis. You know what I mean? People that are like even a little bit homophobic or like whatever it is. Like, it's just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I guess that's partly black and white thinking, but I think you know what I mean. And I'm going to shut up now and let you continue.
It's black and gray thinking. There's the evil and then there's the slightly less evil. And then there's the good.
And they're still evil.
I know. And then the good are the individuals who are doing this kind of shit, you know?
Yes. Yes.
And so
the Keanu Reeves of our race.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm like trying to picture Keanu Reeves playing her in the movie. But I know that it's not allowed. OK, anyway. So she gets fired but she keeps working with music the rest of her life. And one of her whole things that she ends up having to do is that the whole story that I'm telling you, this whole bombing plot, people took the gay angle out of it in history. Like, even though Willem's last fucking words were like, never let them say that homosexuals are cowards, people were just like, look at these great resistance fighters, and like, never talk about their sexuality. And so it wasn't until
that
the 90s.
Proves, like, history is all made up, and made up by mostly straight white men.
Yeah, totally.
Don't trust history books. Sorry, go ahead.
No. I mean, and so it's in the 90s when she's able to like tell them like, no, the fact that we are like gay is fucking part of this and needs to be part of the legacy. Mm-hmm. And she dies in 1995, but she has a good fucking run of it. Another guy, Karl Groger, he was part Jewish, although he'd been baptized Catholic. He'd been born in Austria. His father was a lawyer, and his father was like defended the people who later became Nazis. But young Karl, he was a social democrat and he was a medical student, and he gets the fuck to Amsterdam as soon as he can to get away from the Nazis. But then the Nazis come after, of course, and he gets conscripted into the German army. And then they quickly figure out that he's part Jewish and kick him out. So he joins the resistance. He works on a newspaper called Rattenkreuz or something. Rat Poison, which is a fucking punk rock name for a goddamn newspaper.
Yes. Super metal.
Yeah. And I think he's one of the medical students who sedates the guards. And I think he's the only one of the medical students who gets executed, but I'm not 100% certain about that. But his last letter to his parents includes the line, "I believe that with this one action, I brought more boon to humanity than an entire life as a physician would have done." And he's probably right.
Yeah. No, I think so too. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's like, what will shift the thinking of humanity versus what, you know what I mean? Like,
totally.
The fact that he had even like a nudge of that arrow is so much more helpful than versus, like, I don't know. I was gonna say, oh my god, I was gonna say delivering a baby, but maybe I should not say that.
I mean, like, doctors could do lots and lots of good stuff, and I'm entirely in favor of it. But he, like,
I know,
but he definitely saves more literal, just immediate lives just by fucking burning 800,000 records. And he, like,
yes.
Yeah, and you're right. He also just shows that people can stand up for shit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then another one, you've got another Willem, Willem Sandberg. And he was a typographer, which seems like a good skill set if you're going to become a counterfeiter. And he helped plan the whole thing. And then he goes underground and he survives. He's hidden by a dentist friend after the bombing. And he keeps up his typographic work. He like keeps doing his art while he's underground, mm-hmm. and he releases 19 experimental typographic pamphlets because he's a fucking artist while he's on the run. And I kind of love that too. Like, he set aside his art a little bit, but then he was like, oh, but now I have all this time to work on my art because I'm hiding from Nazis. Yeah.
I got to express myself. I'm an artist.
Yeah. And he designs the plaque for all of his dead friends that hangs on the building where the attack happened. And he goes on to direct one of the more important museums in Amsterdam, the Stedelijk.
You are listening to CKUD in Montreal!
Good afternoon. You're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked at the CKT 90.3 FM.